The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am excited to welcome two very talented writers this evening. Jennifer Senior last joined us when her first book was published, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. The book spent 8 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and to this day, it's the only book I've read whose acknowledgement section made me teary-eyed. Her new book, based on her 2022 Pulitzer Prize-winning article in The Atlantic, 20 Years Gone, had the same effect. I expect it'll have the same effect on you. The subject of the book, Bobby McElveen, was a family friend of Jennifer's and a classmate and subject of her interviewer this evening, Mike Sielski, sports columnist at The Enquirer and author most recently of The Rise, about the life of Kobe Bryant. It's great to have them back. Please welcome our guests.
Thank you for that super gracious introduction. It's really nice.
I'm not used to having to pull the microphone up to my mouth. Usually I have to lower it because I'm not that tall. It's an honor to be here, to be speaking with Jen about her book on grief. I told her, we had dinner together before this event, and I told her what I believe to be true, which is that there are certain, and as you all know, I'm sure, this piece was originally published in The Atlantic, won the National Magazine Award, won the Pulitzer Prize, and there are certain pieces in that medium that stand the test of time as truly generationally excellent. I'm thinking of something like Gay Talese writing about Frank Sinatra. I'm thinking about John Sack writing about Vietnam. And I would put Jennifer's piece up there with any of those. And I'm not just saying that because Bobby McElveen and I went to high school and that she was writing about someone who I knew. So Jennifer, let's start in kind of the broadest way possible.
Yep.
How did you come to meet and know Bobby McElveen?
He was my brother's roommate at Princeton for 4 years, and then they lived together in the city as two broke guys, you know, for 4 years. So I knew him as this irrepressible, adorable, miraculously self-invented kid. Yeah.
How did you come to write about him in the manner that you did?
Right. So my editor, I started working for The Atlantic on like April 4th or something, or 5th, and my editor called me, the editor-in-chief called me on April 8th, and it's always like very nerve-wracking when your new boss calls you at home and you're in your pajamas and, you know, like, what are you going to do for me? You know, and he said, look, we were just talking about various things I could do, and he said at some point, look, we're going to do, even though I resist anniversary journalism, we're going to do something about the 20th anniversary of September 11th. And we've got people writing about like the foreign policy implications and about, you know, the kind of the way it's reshaped domestic policy, all these things. What we don't have is a story about actual people. Just taking a flyer on this one because you're a New Yorker, do you happen to know anyone who was affected by this personally? And I said, oh, unfortunately, I do. And so I told him, and he said, go for it. You know, I just said, I think we should look at, you know, four different ways of grieving if Bobby's former fiance will agree to talk to me. You know, we would have four different ways that we could speak to Bobby's brother and Bobby's mom and Bobby's dad and maybe the woman that Bobby was going to marry. And it would be a really interesting study in how idiosyncratic and different grief is for different people.
There's so much going on in these 13,000 words that you write.
13,600.
When you ask who's counting, Jennifer Senior is counting. How did you initially pitch it?
I like that. saying, you know, the varieties of grief. I mean, mm-hmm. that was how I pitched it, you know, saying like, my impression of the McIlvains is that they mourn differently as a couple. And I'm guessing that fraternal love and a fraternal loss is going to be different. And that I just, that was the way I pitched it, as like just looking at four. And I said, look, in my, I can sweep my brother in, you know, if you wanted a best friend, you know, it didn't, he wound up being, you've spoken to my brother. He's a little spacey anyway. Like, you know, he doesn't, have, so, but I mean, my niece is here, so she knows that that's true. But yes, they, so it's, I just thought like, I can't, you know, there was no room for him in this piece. So, but that was how I pitched it. Or, yeah.
How well did you know Bobby and his family before he passed away?
I knew Helen. I mean, Helen and I had been in Florida. I mean, I knew everybody. And I loved Helen because we had hung out in Florida with my mom, trying on reading glasses together. And I adored, I mean, I'd met Jeff and I knew that I liked Jeff. I knew Bobby. I knew and loved Bobby, but I knew and loved him as like my brother's BFF. You know, I thought that Bobby, like I said, he was this miraculously self-invented creature, and like all miraculously self-invented people, it was like he'd been sort of yanked in, like it was as if he had like hurtled into the world as if from a slingshot. He was just highly vectored. He was super motivated and super, and whenever I saw him, he had opinions and he had lots of, you know, he had ideas and he had takes, you know, there were things about it. And I found his company very charming. I think you knew him better than I did. And I'd love to ask you, because you wrote that unbelievable piece for The Inquirer, you know, wrote all about, it was so beautifully done, about him scoring 16 points off of Kobe and, you know, his teammates, you know, when they were young. You went to high school with him. I mean, you probably had a much more textured, and what I liked actually about your piece, if I can just say, is you resisted hagiography. I mean, you actually confessed that you had like ambivalent feelings about him and that you mourned who he seemed to have become. And it was such an interesting, because of course we all mourn who he could have become, right? I mean, it was...
Yeah, I didn't know him as well as any number of people in the audience did.
Yeah.
But I will say that I think...
I adored him, yeah.
Yeah, I think we were at similar places in our lives and were engaging with the world in a similar way, in that we were both pretty intelligent, pretty competitive, and pretty insecure in a lot of ways. And so there was a tendency for us, like on the surface, if you looked at our backgrounds, you'd have thought, that's exactly the same kid in a lot of ways. They should be fast friends. And in the reality, we were more rivals in some ways.
Right.
And we were both kind of looking to get an edge on the other one in places where we could. Now, Bobby was a much, much, much better athlete and basketball player than I was. So I didn't try to compete with him there, as you know, but it was more about the academics with us.
Right.
And what I loved about what you wrote was that, and it's not, it wasn't just that piece, as glorious as it was a smaller piece that you did for New York Magazine in the aftermath of Bobby's death, where I first kind of thought, wow, this is not the kid I knew in high school. He evolved, he changed. This is not the kid I remember.
Yeah.
And as you said, that's what broke my heart, was that I didn't get to know that kid.
You know, I wonder, I mean, when people are, there's a certain kind of person who, they're so ambitious and they're so driven, but the world is telling them, like, slow down.
Yeah.
You know, you're not there yet. You know, you'll get there, but you are not yet all that. You know, you're junior still. I mean, he died so young, but he had tons of responsibilities at that point. Mm-hmm. He was already rising fast through the ranks of Merrill. I mean, of Merrill, he was kind of already a big-ish deal. And I feel like once people are acknowledged for being what they are meant to be, they're starting to live out their destiny, they relax a little.
Yep.
They calm down. And they don't, and I think that might have, and that rivalry you're describing, it makes perfect sense. I mean, there's a pair of those in every high school, and it's in almost always the two smartest people where they're kind of circling each other. Like,
well, I wasn't that. Bobby was. I was.
Well, but you know what I mean? I get that. I can see that.
So there was an inherent challenge in you writing this piece because you knew the McElveen family as well as you did. How do you go about approaching a piece in that way in which you, as a writer, as a journalist, you want to tell a true story. You want to be honest. But at the same time, these are people who you care about. And you...
A lot.
The last thing you would want to do is really harm them in any way. That's your instinct. But you also have an obligation to the story that you need and want to tell. How did you balance those two competing forces?
Right. Well, lying awake very late at night. I mean, I mean, it wasn't that hard, honestly. I mean, there were some things I was trying to work out in my head about how to do. But, and by the way, I also knew Bob Senior. I mean, I really loved him. I should say that. I think I basically said to my editors, it's the family friendship first. You know, like, that's going to matter more. Mm-hmm. They need to know what's going to be in it. And I think, and the McElveins knew what was going to be in it. They knew ahead of time. I mean, they had a very good sense of what was, there were not any surprises. They didn't open up the magazine and go, whoa, what's that? Mm-hmm. You know, I firmly believe that this was not the Pentagon Papers, right? No one need, the McElveins graciously not only let me into their, you know, kitchen where I was like helping myself to their like pots and pans and making myself an omelet as I was like literally as I was, you know, talking to them.
You get a Pulitzer and free food. This is great.
And I got the eggs, yes. But like it was my sense that, you know, unless you are talking, look, Steve Bannon, when I wrote about Steve Bannon, he had no clue what was coming, right? And that's as it should be. Steve Bannon should never know what's coming. but I think that, you know, and if you're writing about whatever, any kind of politician, that obviously you're not going to give them a preview, any investigative piece. You're running after Harvey Weinstein, you don't give them a preview. If you're talking about normal people, you know, they're, I think, entitled to a pretty decent sense of what you're writing about them because they're graciously helping you out.
So, as I said earlier, there's a lot going on in this, what is now a book. There is the grieving of the McElveen family. There is a diary / journal that is almost a mystery story throughout the course of the piece. There is the mystery of a particular phrase, and I'm framing things this way because for those of you who haven't read the piece, I don't want to give anything away.
You can say life loves on because it's like on page two.
Well, there you go. Okay. Yeah, life loves on. Yeah. You know, and there's a mystery surrounding that phrase. How did you manage to tie together all of these threads? There's those. There's the component of your friendship with the family. There's the component of saying something deep and profound about grief and the need to maybe draw on a little bit of expertise from people outside of yourself and the family. When you sat down in front of the laptop or the notepad or whatever, your iPhone, whatever you use to write, how did you manage to tie all those threads together?
I mean, I sweated that for a while because there were, like you said, a lot of different moving parts. I knew that the diary was going to be the through line. There was a lost diary. Bobby had a diary on his desk when he died. He was an avid diarist, and he wrote novels on the side. He was just, he was a good writer. And his final diary was on his desk when he died. And when Bob Sr. was clearing out his room, he gave it to the woman that Bobby was going to propose to. She asked for it. She saw that her name was all over it. And he was trying to be kind, and he was in a fugue state, as anybody would be. And it was only afterwards that sort of Helen pointed out, this was like the last thing our son wrote, and I would like to see it. And Helen tried to get it back, and Jen had her reasons for hanging on to it and wouldn't give it back. And I had the same fantasies as Helen. I mean, anger that Helen did about this diary. I wanted it back. And I obsessed about it as much as anyone did. I had fantasies about like MacGyvering my way into like Jen's apartment and grabbing it and getting it and, you know, returning it to Helen. I really wanted it, you know. And so I knew. And have you ever listened to the podcast Heavyweight by any chance?
No.
Has anybody in the audience? It's so great. It is so. Of course, yes. I know the person who. Anyway, so it's a fabulous podcast in which the host is in the closure business. Like what he does is he runs around. He will literally do the following. Somebody will call him up and say, "These girls dumped me in middle school, and I'm now 45." And I've always wanted to know why they dumped me. And
I have to listen to this podcast.
and he finds them. And he finds the girls who dumped the girl. And it, you know, or my favorite babysitter just one day never showed up. And he finds the babysitter who's now 60 years old, you know, and like, why didn't you show? Like, mm-hmm. what went on? You know, the famous exam. Anyway, and I thought, I want to be in the closure business. Like the host of Heavyweight. I want that to structure the whole. So, okay, at least I had the structure around the diary predicated on getting the diary back. Mm-hmm. Of course, I was lucky to get it. And then the rest kind of fell into place. It was sort of straightforward kind of magazine architecture in that I went systematically person by person through the family. In the middle, there was this mystery. Right, I say in the beginning, life loves on. Where did this phrase come from? The McIlvaines knew that Bobby had written it, but nobody could find it. And it was this kind of mad hunt to try and figure out where it came from. And that was a long and agonizing kind of process. And it had a twist that none of us were expecting. And so that sort of landed plop in the middle, because what else do you do with it if it's not about somebody else? Right. So I don't know. You know, I did a lot of organizing. I don't sleep much, so I did a lot of like kind of 4 a.m. organizing. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of that.
I know the feeling.
Yeah.
You write at one point, you're writing about Bob Sr. and Helen and Jeff dealing with their grief, and they're speaking to a counselor who tells them, imagine you're all at the top of a mountain and you all have broken bones and can't help each other. You have to find your own way down, meaning descending the mountain is presumably getting over and past your grief. And you speak to a psychology professor who says to you, some people never get down the mountain at all.
Yep.
Did you need to hear that from the professor before you recognized it in the McIlvaines, wherever you found it, or did you already see it and were looking for a way to kind of express it?
I think it was the former. I think I called that professor early on, and I don't think I would have had the antenna out to find it or to recognize it otherwise. Maybe I would have, but, you know, I don't want to give myself that kind of credit. I think she sort of tipped me off. By the way, I think that's a flawed metaphor.
Okay, why?
Yeah. Because some people are more comfortable living in their grief. It is a way of making sure that they are spending time in the company of the person that they lost. And that's perfectly legitimate.
You write at one point in the piece, I credit Bobby with teaching me a valuable lesson. If you're going to cede the power of the last word to someone else, you'd better be damn sure that person deserves it. You then end the piece, the book, with a last line from Bobby. A, was that on purpose?
Oh, yeah. I knew where the door was. That was the thing. I knew exactly where the exit was.
B, how much did your perspective on feelings about Bobby change from the time you started working on this piece until the time you completed it?
Oh, that's a great question. If I can just say something, I ended it on a quote and it went right by 3/4 of my editors because I didn't italicize it. I needed to italicize it for people to know. It's funny what fonts and futzing can sort of telegraph.
Sometimes editors need semaphore flares and signals. Right. Like, and, hello, this is what I'm doing.
A belt and suspenders.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So I think seeing Bobby's final diary, there were some really profound, beautiful observations in that diary that, I mean, I'd had conversations with Bobby where I was very taken by how thoughtful he was and how introspective he was. And I knew that he could be philosophical. There are a couple of really beautiful gems in there that I don't want to spoil, but like they were just great. And I thought it was also just hard because then you just think if he were your age now, like what, I mean, I can't even imagine, you know, how formidable he'd be as a thinker. But he was wise, you know, and I didn't really realize how wise, because I also kind of knew him a bit as a wise ass, and I knew him as like kind of, you know, I don't know, he was full of beans, you know, but
can you tell the story of the dinner at your parents' house?
Oh my God.
Please.
I don't know if the McElvains know this. It wasn't, no, it was like, it was graduation dinner, and we were all sitting there, and the grown-ups were all talking, and everybody was bored, and so Bobby, I was sitting catty-cornered to him, and he just looked at me at one point and went, just gave me this wink, and I thought, I'm 6 years older than you. What are you doing? Like, but he was so intrepid. He was cowed by nothing.
What was the initial reaction to the piece when it came out in The Atlantic?
I was really surprised by it. It was immediate, and it was a cascade. I mean, I started hearing from when Oprah tweets your piece, you know, things are crazy. I mean, she was responding to Ava DuVernay, if I'm pronouncing her name right. She was,
I have no idea.
Yeah, but like, who? I mean, it was, and it went across the political spectrum, right? If you've got like everybody from like Cheryl Strayed to like Piers Morgan, you know, that's weird. Mm-hmm. But I think everybody has loved and grieved, and therefore, it's not that weird, you know?
Yeah, and I think that speaks to both the power of your writing.
But also the material.
The power of Bobby,
yeah.
I think.
Oh, yeah.
That this was somebody who people wanted to get to know in a way that's pretty rare.
Yeah, he's very appealing. Even, I mean, you wrote about him, I think, longer in your piece than I wrote. I mean, I only had like 800 words. I mean, I had so many things, as you said, so many moving parts. But even based on that, the brief outlines that I gave of him, people felt like they knew him, felt like they knew somebody like him. For a brief time, somebody was noodling around to do a screen, Josh Radner, who,
yeah.
So he was noodling around trying to do a screenplay of this, and he was like, I was like Bobby as a kid. And I'm like, I mean, you know, people identified very, yeah.
We're going to open it up to questions in just a minute. I have one more question I want to ask Jen, because you've experienced what any writer or journalist has the rare privilege to experience. What was winning the Pulitzer Prize like?
So I found out, I'm old, right? I mean, and so if you've been around long enough, you know a lot of people, and you know people who are connected to the Pulitzer. So I found out way before they announced it. And it was just a friend.
That's nothing but being a good reporter. A good reporter finds things out before they happen.
I will admit that I did ask this one person who didn't want to answer directly in a text. So instead, this person sent me the emoji. Is it GIF or GIF? Thank you. The GIF of Bill Murray in Lost in Translation doing the Suntory commercial where he's in a tux and he turns around and he points to you. And like that was all that I got. And I was like, oh. And I showed it to my husband, and he was like, do you think that means? And I was like, this person's not being a jerk. Like, yes, I think that means. But, I mean, I was, like, in my fleece, like, sous-chefing, like, cutting up garlic for my husband, and my teenage son was like, when are we eating? You know, it was, like, anticlimactic in that weird way. Like, they announced it over, and then they announced it over Zoom. You know, like the National Magazine Awards, you're all dressed up and, like, you know who the finalists are, and like when, and it's a surprise when they announce it, and you go on stage, and your editor gives a speech, and it's all very nice. This was so bizarrely anticlimactic, but it was, of course, really great, and the ceremony was great, and Helen was my date.
And you get a new first name, Pulitzer Prize winning writer.
That follows
Jennifer
you. Yeah, Singer. It's like it's cool.
I'd like to open it up for questions now.
I have not read the book. I'll start there. In preparation for writing, did you do research about grief and do a lot of study about grief and then applied what you'd learned to this situation?
No, that's a great question. And so the answer is yes. I specifically asked Helen what books had helped her. And I did start reading like different theories of grief. And two things happened. First of all, the problem is that all of the books about grief, like, do and don't apply. You know, like, people do not always grieve in stages sequentially. logically. I mean, everybody grieves so idiosyncratically that the theories are sometimes applicable and sometimes comically inapplicable. Like, they really, so it's good if you want to fly over. The other thing is that then I thought, I had a draft. Well, not a draft. It was like the second section where I was kind of trying to explain what I was up to, where I was quoting a lot of them. And I sent it to a friend of mine who has been here at this library. His name is Bob Kolker. He wrote a really great book called Hidden Valley Road. And he was like, oh, God, get all the experts out of here. I just want to hear from the family. I don't want to hear from these people at all. Get rid of them. Like, the family will teach us everything we need to know. It was so counterintuitive to me. I usually hide behind other people's scholarship. I am so afraid. I had never done a story like this, where I just told a straight-up kind of tale of, I don't want to say this was not a yarn, but it was like a narrative piece, right? Like, you know, narrative nonfiction. I'd never done it where it kind of, so I did. And then I threw it all out. But I'm sure it silently informed what I did, if you know, yeah.
So you just mentioned that you were sort of surprised, if I'm correct, that everybody from like Piers Morgan, Cheryl Strayed, ran the political. Why was that surprising that they all had the same?
Because Twitter polarizes everything. I can't. They can polarize a can of tuna fish. You know, like, I just can't believe. I've never had that experience on Twitter in my life. When I wrote about, I mean, and I shouldn't have been surprised about this, but when I simply wrote about having long COVID and being sick, I mean, it took about an hour before everybody wanted to know whether I was vaccinated, and then it became like a war about what, I mean, you know, and I had written about how very sick I was. It was not, like, people could have just been nice, right? You know, like, and so that was just one option. It would have been the civilized thing to do. And I just thought at some point this is going to go south, and someone's going to just find something. They'll harp on one sentence and it will all go south, you know? And also, I don't know, the way that 9/11 can be politicized, you know, people could have brought up Iraq, they could have brought up the wars, the endless war, they could have made it about Biden and our, you know, clumsy exit from Afghanistan. I don't know, you know, like, I was just bracing myself. But you're right. I mean, now it looks like, I mean, people should be gracious about this, and they were. So it was nice. It was affirming.
I'm curious how your process, your daily work, was different writing the book, or different or not different from your usual journalistic.
Well, this covers. Was the book is the actual piece, just bound between covers. So, I mean, when I wrote a book, it was, believe it or not, it wasn't all that different. But just to be clear, this appeared in The Atlantic, and it is now just a pretty slender little volume bound between, you know, elegantly packaged and all that, that I'm just excited can be passed from person to person, you know. In a weird way, I think that, you know, having written a book, it's not, I mean, I did have this one moment when I wrote my book years ago where I remembered coming back from a trip where I'd gathered all this stuff, and I was speaking to my brother on the phone, and I said, I was getting quotes, I was getting anecdotes, and then I said, although I'm writing a book, I guess they should be characters. Oh my God, I have to go back. Like, I realized I needed to dive so much deeper. Like, I still was in the sort of superficial gloss of journalism mode. But in terms of, like, structure and all those things.
Here's a follow-up. What is your day-to-day writing process?
I tend to report and report and report until I'm sick of it. Like, that's my threshold. I know I have enough when I'm tired of it. And then I do things sequentially. I can't start writing in the middle. A lot of my colleagues can. A lot of my colleagues write drafts, and they write lousy first drafts. They do, it's almost like action painting. It'll just be a jet of words that they will throw out on the page, and they are very unafraid of writing and rewriting, whereas I can't let a sentence out, you know, without liking. I buff it to a high shine, and then I do the next one, and it's all perspiration. And that's actually how a lot of us do it. I don't know how do you?
I can start in the middle. I'll have an idea and just put it down on paper.
I hate people like you. I'm so jealous.
Sorry.
Yeah. That's so great.
No, I'll come up with something and put it down, and it may be the first graph, and maybe somewhere in the middle it may end up being the end. But I work I need to get something down first. It might be a, like if I'm writing a column for the Inquirer, it might be a quote that I think I'm probably going to end up using. So I just put it down, and now, okay, instead of having to write a full 900 words for my column, now I only have to write 750 right. because the 150 is already down.
Yeah, and it's, no, it's getting over the yips or something. Yeah. I mean, it's to avoid the yips. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I've definitely like surrounded, I will occasionally have a flash of something where I will surround an idea with text, but like that's not until I've done the top. I can't do it. Yeah.
So first I want to thank you so much for your piece. We had a family friend who worked for Cantor Fitzgerald and did not make it out.
Oh, wow.
And I think with 9/11 stories, we sort of think of that as like the end. And as your piece showed, there's obviously 20 years now.
Yeah.
Sorry. So I guess my question for you was, you talked a little bit about being neutral in this story, but did you ever like have the impulse to sort of help Helen and Bob Sr. like process that grief?
I wouldn't have been, that's a great question. And also, I still don't know the right things to say. You know, it's funny after, but I'm very sorry. I wouldn't have known the right things to say to Helen and Bob or Jeff. I mean, to help them process. I mean, like the most I could do was like, I went through Bobby's writing and I put stickies all over the places where I think Helen and Bob and Jeff will, the things that they will want to read. You know, because it's really, he's written a lot of stuff. You know, so what could I do? I could be like an archivist or a curator and I could find the cool stuff for them to. But because I know them, it's perfectly easy for me to like hug them in the middle of a conversation or whatever. But like, it takes a very special kind of person to be really good at that, you know, to help people process their grief. I mean, I'm a good listener. I ask the right questions, but I don't know if I'd be very good at, I don't think I'm above average at helping people process really tough losses. I don't think so, is the truth. I did what I could do. You know, I can read the, yeah.
Your story is such a powerful story. How do you get on to the next story?
Oh, God. Well, thank you. So I wrote two more after that. One was about friendship in midlife, and it wasn't as good. Nothing's going to be as good. I said to Helen, I'm not a religious person. I don't believe in this kind of thing, but I swear I felt like I had Bobby's help in this thing. I know that's weird, but like, I can't believe I'm even saying it. But I'm a very committed non-believer. But you know, this came out, and then I was like, well, I'll never do anything like that again. And that's fine. The next piece that I did about friendship in midlife, I liked. It was different enough that. It was different enough, you know. And then I had no choice. My editor said, democracy is on the line. Pick a bad guy, any bad guy. And I wrote about Steve Bannon. So, I mean, at least there's no pressure in that you're not competing. You know, I mean, it's so different. And so, yeah, it was so different that I didn't feel like I had to outdo this piece. Like, now I'm writing something that's personal again, and I do feel pressure, like, oh, my God, it's going to be held to the same standard, and I'm not going to do as good a job. I'm just not. You know, everything aligned on this piece in a way that just, it's like, I was saying to Mike, it's like a comet. It's like one of these comes around every 35 years. It happens, like, once in a journalist's career, that everything just kind of aligns like that. It just doesn't happen. Thank you. That was a very generous question.
So two quick observations. First of all, Mike, I want you to know that the first 200 words of Jen's piece, I stopped and said, wait a minute, I know this name.
Oh.
And went back and Googled your article because I had read your article in the Inquirer.
Thank you.
And second, Jen, I will also let you know that Mike basically said before the announcement that they may as well just cancel the Pulitzer if you didn't win, and I agree with him 100%. But my question to you is this, and what I, there's a lot there, but one thing that really struck me and overwhelmed me was that you told the story of one person, and I'm thinking there's 2,000 other family stories just from that one event.
I know, 2,800, right?
There's families and children and parents and you know and boyfriends and girlfriends and fiancés and everything else, and that was really overwhelming. Did you hear from many of them?
Yes, I did. I heard from people who had lost people in every possible conceivable setting, But I definitely heard from other families who had lost people on September 11th. I'm speaking tomorrow in Florida at a synagogue. The rabbi's brother died of a 9/11-related cancer, they think. I mean, the movie option originally, it wasn't an option, like they were looking at it. The director's brother is married to a 9/11 widow. I mean, like, it's really amazing. Like, yes, but as you're pointing out, these are like kind of tertiary connections in a funny way, or you know, it's the director's brother's, but you know, if you look at it that way, there's like what, 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 people who were 500,000 who were mourning very hard, right? Who were really in pain, in direct pain. And you could see in New York City very quickly, like by the first or second week, who was tying one on at night, you know, having a cocktail, and who was in real mourning, you know, who really had lost someone. You know, you could see that by September 18th, I would say. But yes, I did hear from other families. But I also heard from people who just had lost, you know, who had lost children in other settings, and parents and best friends and siblings. And
I'd like to thank everyone for coming. And of course, I'd like to thank Jen for being here.
I would like to thank the library and Andy, I don't know where he is, but for inviting me. And Mike, you're amazing.
Thanks. Thank the McIlvaines and the McIlvaines, their family, for being here as well.
And all of them.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.